this morning from Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. Some of you may recognize this as a passage right at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and so we're going to be looking at that this morning. First of all, how many of you like salt on your food? Okay, so there are a lot of sodomly challenged people here. That's good. I don't feel so bad now. There are certain things that you cannot eat properly without salt. French fries, testify on the front row, French fries, but there's one worse, rice. There is nothing worse than a bowl of rice with no salt. And you can't put enough butter on salt to simulate rice. You cannot do it to simulate salt. You can't do it. And have you noticed that you can't put enough salt on rice? It's like you pour salt on it and you stir it up and it's like it disappears. You got to put a lot on there. Which is why this is mostly water. Because I eat so much salt, I retain a lot of fluid. If I cut salt out of the diet, I'd probably lose 50 pounds like that. But then I couldn't eat rice, and well, that would ruin everything. But salt is really important. So in a diet, it was really important in the biblical period, and probably more so than you realize. So this morning, we're going to start with Matthew chapter 5, verse 13. Jesus is talking to this crowd of believers at what we call the Sermon on the Mount. And so he has just finished the Beatitudes. Now, it's really important for context to kind of understand what's going on. He's just finished teaching on the Beatitudes, and then he intros the next section of this sermon with this phrase. He says, "You are the salt of the earth." Okay? So he identifies disciples as the salt of the earth. Now, how many of you are familiar with this passage where Jesus talks about your salt and your light? Most of you have heard this. Okay. So when Jesus comes in and starts his message, he says, "You are the salt of the earth." There's some really interesting nuances to what that term means that a lot of times when we talk about this passage, we don't really look at. If you go back to the Old Testament, and there are a couple of passages I'm going to mention. You don't have to, if you want to write these down or something, you can look at them later. But I wrote these down, and I didn't give them to Catherine because I didn't want to make her flip to all these. But Leviticus chapter 2, verse 13 talks about how salt was a key ingredient in most of the sacrifices that were made to God. Whether it was a grain offering or a meat offering, most of the time those included salt. Also, in Numbers 18, chapter 18, verse 19, and then in 2 Chronicles 13, 5, it tells us that salt was used in covenants between people. Now, can anybody guess why you would use salt when you're making a covenant with somebody? Because it's a preservative. Salt is a preservative. And so it was symbolic of preserving the covenant between two people. So if you were entering into some sort of covenant with a person, like a contract, salt would be used in that covenant to signify it being a long-term thing, that it would be preserved over time. And so salt had a lot of significant uses in Scripture, besides that it was used to flavor food. It was all, and as a preservative in a time of no refrigeration, how anybody know how salt was used in that context? Somebody on the front row, I won't say who it was, Caleb, just said, "Oh, they use salt as a refrigerator." Any of you ever had a really, really good piece of country ham? When my dad used to preach at Christian Hope in Plymouth, there was this gentleman. His name was Hallie Browning, and he lived on Long Ridge Road, and he had this smokehouse thing in his yard, just a little shed. And you would get, we'd go to eat lunch with him, and you get a piece of country ham, and it might be about, you know, so long and about that thick. I mean, that was good, good country ham. And if you ate just a little bit of it, you had to travel with a thermos for the next couple of days because there was so, I mean, that it was just so salty, but boy, it was good. And I asked Mr. Howie one time, because I was just a kid, I said, why is there so much salt in this? And he said, if something ever happens and the grocery stores close, and I'm thinking, COVID-19, I'm glad he didn't live to see this, but if something ever happened, he said, that meat, that stuff will keep for 5 years. I was like, well, I bet it will. That was some good stuff. Okay, so meat as salt as a preservative in the New Testament was pretty common. So as Jesus gets up, and remember, all these people who are hearing this are Jews, and so they're familiar with the covenants and they're familiar with the sacrifices. So they understand the significance of salt just beyond how we think of it as table salt. And so with all that information in mind, Jesus looks at these people and says, you are the salt of the earth. Okay? So this really goes beyond the concept of us as people bringing some sort of flavor to the world, which I'm sure some of you do. We won't get into which flavors, just, you know. But this is not just about people as a flavoring. This is more. And I would even contend that it's more than just people as a preservative. It is really about the significance of what salt meant to those people and to understand that this was an integral part of the sacrifice system. It was an integral part of the covenant relationship. And remember, Jesus has come into the world for one primary purpose, and that is to restore the broken covenant between God and man that man broke in the garden. And so with all that information as a backdrop, Jesus looks at these people and he says, you were the salt. You are an integral part of the covenant relationship that my Father is going to have with the world. You are the covenant. You are the people that will be the covenant. My disciples will be the people who make the covenant, who preserve the covenant. And if you look around at the world right now, you could probably argue that the covenant between God and his people is really in a shaky place right now, right? I mean, as we look around at everything that's going on and we say, man, there's really got to be some work done on this covenant. Well, guess what? Whose job is it to seal the covenant between God and humanity? The church. We are the salt. Jesus says, you are the salt. You are the binders of the covenant. You are the ones who will bring the world back into covenant through my Son with me. And so there's a tremendous amount of significance when Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. He says, you are the people who will make this covenant last. But then he says this, but if the salt becomes tasteless, or some translations might say useless, and I think some even say if it loses its saltiness, you can't define a word with the word, but some do, okay? If the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? And listen to this next line. He says, it is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Now, I want you to take a moment and think about the implication of what Jesus is saying to his disciples when he throws this line out. He says, you guys, my followers, and as we look down through the generations, Jesus is talking to us as his disciples, as his followers. He says, guys, you are the salt. You are the binders of the covenant. You are an integral part of the sacrifice system. You are a key ingredient to my covenant with mankind. And if you stop fulfilling that role, you know what he says? Well, he says it right here. He says what? You're useless. You're useless. Now, How many of you have ever known someone who identified as something but did not participate in that something? Okay. Now, if you've ever had a study group at school, and every study group has one of these people, we call them the mooch. The mooch is the person who comes to the study group who doesn't do any work, who doesn't offer any information, who does not provide any benefit. They're just there to find out what you know so they don't have to study on their own. How many of you have ever had to work on a project at work and you had people on your project team that if they died, you wouldn't notice something happened to them? I haven't seen Fred in 3 weeks. Oh, he passed away. Who knew? He's provided the same amount of work since the funeral that he provided beforehand. You know, you've all had those people. You know who I'm talking about. Some of you are going, oh, I work with that person. Their name isn't Fred. And by the way, thank you for not saying their name because we're live streaming this. And they could be home watching. In fact, they probably should be home watching. Jesus says, when my disciples stop discipling, okay, when the salt stops being salty, then as far as I'm concerned, it could be thrown out. Now, think about this. There are a lot of people who think that the most important thing in the world is to identify as a Christian. They call themselves Christian. They might even have one of them really cool Jesus Fish bumper stickers on their car, you know? Or they might have one of those bumper stickers like, you know, it's one of the one I hate the most. God is my co-pilot. Like, he doesn't want to fly your plane. You know, he wants you to fly. That which is this the worst bumper sticker ever. If you've got one of those, I apologize, but I will help you remove it if you'd like me to. There are people out there who think that the singular most important thing in the world is to identify as a Christian because somehow God won't be able to tell the difference. Because, you know, we all look the same to him. Well, that's a Christian. All my sheep look alike. But Jesus tells his disciples, and keep in mind, this is still early in his ministry, and so he is setting a tone for what it means to be a disciple. And he says, look, it's not enough for you to be here on this mountain listening to me. That doesn't do anybody anything. It's not enough to identify as a disciple or a Christian. It's not enough this morning to sit here and go, hey, dude, you know I'm faithful. I risked the COVID to come to church. Guys, you risked the COVID to go to Food Lion and Walmart. Some of you are going, well, yeah. I got to get out of the house. Jesus is sending a message to his disciples. And he says, look, if you're not part of the covenant, if you're not part of what is restoring this covenant with the world, if you are not helping bring other people into covenant and sealing that covenant through your life, through your testimony, through your ministry, if you're just coming to the building, sitting in a chair and going, oh, I'm a Christian, I took communion, and that's all I got to do till next Sunday, Jesus says, you're not really good for anything. I just throw you out and trample you underfoot because you're like salt that isn't salty. Any of you ever bought something and got a bad batch of something? My wife yesterday was cutting up a cucumber. Now, I didn't taste test this cucumber because I think I'd ultimately rather put the muzzle of a gun in my mouth than a cucumber. I do not like cucumbers. I just don't like them. Huh? Amen. Okay, I got an amen. There you go. I don't like you, but my wife and my daughter like them. And Stephanie's cutting one up, and she takes a bite of it, and she made this announcement. She goes, "This tastes like pesticides." Now, of course, my immediate question is, "When have you eaten pesticides?" And then she, of course, told me that she'd never eaten pesticides, but if she had, this is probably what they taste like. She said, "Something don't taste right with this. It tastes." It has a bad aftertaste. And then my thought was, as do all cucumbers. But she said there was something specifically wrong with that one. Any of you ever bought something and you got it home and you're like, oh, that's not good. A flat soft drink or a bag of chips that were stale or something, and you're just like, something not right. Now, once you get something like that and you bring it home and you open it and it's not right, what's it good for?
I return it.
You return it. By the way, for the record, I could picture Beverly walking into Food Line with a cut up cucumber going, you can have this back. It was 30 cent and I want my money back. When we have something like that, it's just no good. It would just get rid of it. And so Jesus, telling his disciples, he says, listen, it's not enough to identify as salt. It's not enough to just say, I'm salt. If you're salt, if you identify as salt, but you're not preserving anything, you're not confirming anything, you're not preserving any covenant, you're not doing any of those things, then once that salt isn't salt anymore, throw it out. That's what I'm going to do. I'm gonna throw it out. And by the way, if that sounds familiar, Jesus uses this analogy in a lot of different ways. You might remember the parable of the fig tree. You know, if you've got a fig tree and it doesn't bear any fruit, what is going to happen to it? Cut it down, burn it. It's not good for anything but firewood if it's not producing fruit. So Jesus uses this analogy a number of times throughout his ministry, but in this particular case, he does it with salt. Then in verse 14, he segues into another interesting illustration, and they are connected, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. He says, you are the light of the world. Okay? What is the darkest place you ever remember being? Where? Mammoth Caves. I've never been to Mammoth Cave, but I've heard that places like that, the caves or the caverns where you're like a mile underground? Is it that far down? You're pretty far underground. That's pretty dark. The darkest place for me was the radio station at Johnson Bible College when the power went out because it was a room inside of a room inside of a room with no windows. And so it was totally, totally just dark. Now, I've spent some lovely evenings in Crestville when it was cloudy and there was no moon or stars. That's pretty black. That's pretty dark. You can't see. And if you've ever run into a tree doing that, you understand what I'm talking about if you're from the country. Swan Quarter, is that kind of Mamski? Is that like that? Yeah, when you have the country. Those of you, by the way, who have never been out of the big city, you do not understand what dark is because you have street lights and you just don't get it. And I remember my kids going to Crestville and being like, wow, it's really dark out here. I'm like, yeah, it's not like the city. Okay, so Jesus says, you are the light of the world, okay? You are the ones who provide light. He says, a city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. We should tattoo this verse on the forehead of every camper when they come to church camp. Because you'll be outside the dorm at night, and it'll be lights out, and you'll see kids with flashlights in their room, throwing them around the room, and you'll see light. And then you walk in, and they turn them off, and they're like, what? We're like, dude, you had a flashlight on. No, we didn't. Do you realize that we can see the light outside? And they look at the window, and they're perplexed. How did the light get out of the window? How did that happen? We're like, because it's glass. That's how it works. When you turn on a light in the darkness, guess what? People can see it. In fact, that is, surprisingly enough, its purpose. That is its purpose. So Jesus, after telling the people that they are salt and what happens when the salt loses its saltiness, he then comes back with this. He says, you are the light of the world. Okay? You are the light of the world. And he says, when you take a city and you put it on a hill, it can't be hidden. Now, why would Jesus use that analogy? He says, when you put a city on a hill, he says it can't be hidden. Now, this is really an interesting way he approaches this. He doesn't say if a light loses its lightiness, because that doesn't happen. It's either a light or it's not. But this is what he says. He says, if you are a city and you put that city on a hill, you can't hide the light. Now, what that means is, to the disciples, he says, if you are the light of the world, if, and that's the key, if you're the light of the world, your light can't be hidden. How many of you have ever been in a situation where you felt tempted, and we'll just stop there, I won't say if you actually did or not. How many of you have ever been in a situation where you felt tempted to hide your faith? Now, I know, I see around the room, everyone's going, I don't think we're supposed to answer that out loud. I'm not going to raise my hand. I would dare say a lot of us have been in circumstances or situations where we were surrounded by people who did not share our belief system. And in those moments, when something comes up, some topic comes up, or some joke is being told, or something's being said, and you're like, you know, I probably should say something, but I don't want to say anything because I'm alone in this crowd and I don't want people to know what my view on this is because my view might not be very popular. I would guess most of us have been in that situation at some point. So Jesus says, look, when you put a light on a hill, you can't hide it. You can't hide it. Now, what do you think Jesus is trying to tell his disciples? What do you think he's trying to tell them by that story? You put a city on a hill, you can't hide the light. No matter how hard you try, you can't hide the light of a city on a hill. What is he telling his disciples? If you're one of my disciples and you're the light of the world, guess what you can't do? You can't hide it. It's not even a question of do you want to hide it. It's a question that you can't hide it. If you're one of my people, you're going to shine. People are going to see it. You can't hide that. You can't hide that you're one of my disciples. Because everybody's going to see it. It's going to be out there for everybody to see. And so he's telling them, he says, look, guys, when you take up the mantle of Christian and you live in a way that honors me, people are going to see it. And that's, in fact, what he says in this next verse. He says, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but they put it on a lampstand and it gives light to all who are in the house. Okay? So, in other words, anywhere we go, no matter the circumstance, no matter the situation, our light is supposed to be on. And when our light is on, guess what? People see it. And here's the funny thing about light. The darker it is, the brighter the light looks. Now think about this. How many of you have ever got up in the morning and you've looked out in the sky and you've seen the moon out early in the morning? Now, does the moon look bright? No. It's just up there. You can see it. It's illuminated by the sun. You can see it, but it's not shining. It's just kind of there. Now, you know why the moon isn't shining like it does at night? Because the sun's out. And the light of the sun completely overwhelms the luminosity of the moon. The moon doesn't shine, and it's not because the sun's not reflecting off of it, because it is. It's just that the sun is so bright that the moon is dim by comparison. But when the sun goes down, what does that moon look like? Man, it's bright. If it's full moon, you're like, man, the moon is really bright tonight. Okay? And it's not that the brightness of the moon changes, it's that the light that it's shining in changes. As our world descends into more and more chaos, as the world gets progressively darker, what should be happening to our light? It should be brighter, right? The light of the church should be getting brighter and brighter and brighter as the world around it gets darker and darker and darker. Let me ask you a question. Is that happening? Do you feel like your light is shining brighter today than it was 6 months ago? Now, that should be an easy question, because if you're like, well, I don't know that I'm shining. I don't know that I'm doing anything different. But my light certainly should be brighter because it certainly seems like there's a lot more darkness around me. And it's amazing how in darkness, one little flame seems like it puts out a lot of light. And so as we look at the chaos and all the things that are going on in our world, and, you know, Solomon said there's nothing new under the sun. We always think that this is the worst situation we've ever had, but the truth of the matter is chaos just repeats. It repeats. But as we look around at all the things going on in our world, there should be a truism that exists that our light is shining brightly in those dark corners of our world where things seem hopeless, because you can't hide the light of a Christian. So here's the question. If you're not putting out any light in these dark times, what do you suppose that would say about you? You aren't very salty, and you might need to change your batteries. Now, let's look at verse 16, okay? Jesus says, "Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify the Father who is in heaven." Now, I want everybody to get a mental picture of that passage, and I'm going to read a verse to you, which, by the way, is in the very next chapter, okay? So in Matthew chapter 6, I want you to listen to what Jesus says, and I want you to tell me where you think if there's a contradiction or not. So in Matthew chapter 6, verse 1, listen to what Jesus says. "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who's in heaven." Okay, so in Matthew 6, 1, he says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you'll have no reward." But in verse 16 of chapter 5, he says, "Let your light shine before men in such a way that they see your good works." Now, what's the difference? It's who gets the glory, right? In Matthew 5, 16, Jesus says, "Let your light shine before men in such a way that they'll see your good works and do what? Glorify the Father who is in heaven." In chapter 6, verse 1, he says, you got to be careful. Don't go out there looking to make yourself look good. Okay? Don't go out there looking to make yourself look good. I am terribly concerned that this has become a dangerous pattern in the church. And when I say the church, I'm not talking about any particular congregation or any particular denomination. I'm just talking about the church in general. We spend a lot of time trying to make our church look good. We want people to come to our church. We want people to think our church is really active in the community. We want to get our name out there. We want people to think, wow, that's a really great church. Now, let me ask you a question. If you're trying to promote your congregation, does that sound more like Matthew 5, 16 or Matthew 6, 1? Because the glory is supposed to go to who? The Father. It's supposed to go to the Father. Now, let me stop right there and say, I'm not saying you shouldn't tell people, we have a really great church, you should come to our church. In fact, you could probably do that more often. But the object of the game as Christians is not to make us look good or even our congregation look good. The object is to make Christ look good, to make him look appealing, so that people can see the good things we're doing and glorify him. And there are a lot of people who glorify churches and pastors and programs more than they glorify God. Right? I'm not making that up, am I? I'm not imagining that. So there's an interesting thing that Jesus seems to be trying to communicate here. He says, Let your light shine before men in such a way that they could see your good works. Okay? Now, here's where this kind of ties in. We go back to the salt thing, okay? As salt, we are preservatives of the covenant. That's what we are. And so Jesus says, let your light shine so people can see that, so that they can see that you're preservatives of the covenant, so they can identify what you are. How many of you have ever gone to the cabinet and you've gotten the wrong thing to put on your food? I was cooking one night. This is the most irritating thing in the world. I was cooking one night, and I thought, this needs a dash of salt. And I was in a hurry, and I wasn't paying attention, and I grabbed the garlic salt. Now, in some meals, that would be okay. This particular dish, no. Garlic salt, no bueno for that dish. My wife's favorite story is we went to Outback one night. She's laughing already. I ordered, this is before I had kids, when I could afford prime rib. So I got the prime rib, and they brought out this lovely baked potato with butter and this nice container of a sour cream looking substance. I won't ruin the end for you by telling you what it was. But I can tell you that I emptied said container into the baked potato and commenced to stir it up in an appropriate manner. And then, all excited about my butter and sour cream, I got a great big fork full of baked potato, butter, and horseradish. Fortunately, we'd been married long enough that I could spit that out. If we had been on a date, I would have had to swallow that stuff. But since we've been married over a year, I just... And my wife goes, what is wrong with you? And I said, that's horseradish. And when the waitress came to the table, I rebuked her in the name of the Lord for bringing me unmarked horseradish. I was like, why did you bring horseradish? She goes, that comes with a prime rib. Which just seemed like apostasy to me, but there's nothing worse than getting the wrong ingredient when you're eating or when you're cooking. That's no fun. So Jesus says, look, if you're the light of the world, people should be able to identify what you are. They can see the salt that's in you. They can see how you are working in that covenant relationship as a preservative. They can see that you're preserving the relationship with Christ. And so this morning, there's a couple of really important questions that I want to leave you with this morning. Number one, are you doing more to preserve people's relationship with Christ than you are to damage people's relationship with Christ? You realize that bad Christians are worse than atheists. Right? You get that, don't you? Because atheists, we know who they are and we don't listen. Okay, that's an atheist. I'm not listening to him talking about God because he's an atheist. He doesn't even believe in God. But when someone pretends to be a Christian and then leads people down the wrong path, that's worse. That's worse. So Jesus says, look, if you're going to be a preservative, if you're going to be the salt of the earth, if you're going to be that thing, then you need to be that thing. You need to be the preservative. You need to be the thing that adds flavor to that relationship with Christ. You need to do that. And then you need to be the light of the world so that everyone can see it. So the question, number one, is are we active preservers of the covenant? First thing I would ask you this morning, are you an active preserver of the covenant between God and man? Number two, is your light on? I want you to imagine this morning, as our praise team comes up to lead us in our communion song, I want you to imagine that you're on a ship. You've been away from home for months, and now you are heading home and you're heading to shore. And you're getting into an area just off the coast of North Carolina, which is commonly known as the graveyard of the Atlantic. And you're sailing in, and you know that any minute now you should see the light from this lighthouse that's going to guide you safely home. But as you approach the coast, you can't find that thing. There's no light anywhere. It's a dark night, cloudy night. There's no light anywhere. You can't see, and the light from the lighthouse isn't there. And so your ship crashes into the rocks, and it sinks. And as you are drowning in the sea, you hear from the shore, "Sorry, I forgot to light the light." That's the day of judgment for people who don't know Christ, who look at you and go, and you're like, "Dude, I'm sorry, I didn't have my light on. I didn't think you wanted to see it. I didn't want to disturb your darkness. You look so happy in the dark. I didn't want to ruin anything. I didn't want to offend you by shining my light." Folks, Jesus puts a really strong emphasis at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And this is a 3-chapter sermon. I don't know if he wrote it that way, but 3 chapters this sermon encompasses. And one of the very first things he does is he said, "Look, if you're going to be my disciple, 2 things. You need to be salt, and you need to be light." History, like I said, Solomon says there's nothing new under the sun, folks, but let me tell you something. In our lifetime, I don't know that there's ever been a time when we needed more salt and more light in the world. And guess who it's up to? It's us. It's not the government. We got all these entities, none of them. The only place that the real salt and light that Christ is talking about is going to come from is from his church, from his people. Not shining the light towards us, but shining the light towards him. Okay? We're going to have our communion hymn this morning, and then Brother Charles Winstead is going to come up and lead us in our communion meditation this morning.